And then I'd ask that you please help me welcome Carol M. from Seal Beach as our speaker tonight.
Fall out of my shoes here. Good evening, my name is Carol and I am an alcoholic. And what an honor to be asked back. Yeah, I remember the days when I was never asked back. And thank you, Lee. Lee is one of my special, special friends. I always have to talk about Lee. You know, he asked me to speak here a couple of months ago, and I said, sure. And then I looked at the date. Oh, my God, the Rolling Stones. Mick Jagger needs me. I can't come. So we rescheduled. And then I looked at my calendar and went, oh, my God, it's the powwow. I can't come. But God in his infinite wisdom always knows what to do with me because I'm here tonight. Somebody else canceled. I was scheduled a couple of months from now, and I was canceled. And I'm meeting my coworker that I've worked with for 9 years and never met before. You know, I mean, face to face. And, you know, I just look at, and Kathy's here from Atascadero. I mean, it's Alcoholics Anonymous really is a big love fest, in case you don't know that. What I would like to know is how many people in here are under a year? You're my people. You're the ones I like to talk to. I'm an alcoholic. I want to give you my vital statistics up front. I am an alcoholic. I have a sobriety date. It's February 16th, 1982. I have a home group. It is the Seal Beach Speakers Meeting. I live in Orange, but Seal Beach Speakers is my home group. And I have a sponsor. I have June G, who lives up in Ventura now. And those are the three anchors I have. And I just got June last year. The person I always reported to was Len Wilder. And he knew everything about me. He knew more about me than I knew about me. He had met my families. He has walked with me for 33 years. I walked into a meeting when I first moved over here from Hawaii, and this Kentuckian decided he was going to run my life without my permission. And he did. And I had lunch with him before he died, and he always told me what to do. And he said, if anything ever happens to me, you call June. So I called June, you know. And then it dawned on me. I'm 37 years sober, and I've never picked my own sponsor. I've always been appointed to people, you know, and that gives you a clue of what I'm like. Anyway, I'm so grateful. If I don't tell you anything else at all, I want to tell you I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. The longer I'm sober, the more amazed I am at what it has done with me, the life it has given me. I am amazed, almost. I mean, now even on the way up, things keep coming back. When they say that more will be revealed, more is revealed. More of the good stuff, but more of the remembrance of what I was like. And I, you know, denial was so strong with me. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll tell you, I loved alcohol. I loved alcohol. My story can be summed up in two lines. Alcohol gave me wings to fly and took away my sky. It took me places I never would have gotten to. I'm the typical story. I took a drink, drink took a drink, then the drink took me. And I fought it all the way to the very, very end because I knew alcohol was the solution. It was the solution to everything that was wrong with me. I had no labels for what was wrong with me. I always felt weird. I knew I was weird. Then alcohol is the only thing that seemed to calm it down. But towards the end, I guess I kept overshooting the mark, and I got into a lot of trouble. It says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to tell you what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now. And I'm a Boston Irish Catholic, which enables me membership from birth. And I come from a very dysfunctional family, which is a very nice term compared to what they were really like. I was thinking one day, you know, I spent my childhood in basements of St. Rita's Church reading the catechism between Bobby Terrell and Jimmy Dowling, learning what God's will was for me. And 50 years later, I was reading the big book in St. Rita's basement with Bobby Terrell and Jimmy Dowling next to me. And I think that gives you a clue of the neighborhood. And but my family was nuts. My mother and father got divorced when I was 2 years old. They were living in Florida. My father was a racketeer. He was bringing all the junkets over to Cuba, all the gamblers over to Cuba. And he was having a good time. I'm an Irish triplet, which means my mother, sweet little Irish woman, gave him three kids in 2 years. The only Irish birth control they had in those days was take an aspirin and put it between your knees and hold it there. It didn't work. You know, so I'm a triplet. I'm the youngest of the three of us. And she finally divorced him and moved to Massachusetts to her dad's home, which she did not want. She hated being back in Lowell, Massachusetts. And she brought us there. And when we got there, we lived in this little house, four-bedroom house, and there were my grandfather and two uncles and an aunt, two brothers, my mom, and me. And it was crowded, and it was crazy. But when Grandpa was alive, everything was okay, because he was the patriarch of the family. And I was his duchess. He used to call me the duchess. And he's taught me to read. He loved reading stories to me, and I give him all the credit for the thing that saved my life, and that is reading. But when he died, I had to pay. The price would be in the favorite. And all hell broke loose. Those uncles who had been maintaining just broke out drinking. They were out getting drunk every night. They were veterans from World War II. They would go out and get drunk. Sometimes Uncle Francis would come home and take a pee in the linen closet. Sometimes Uncle James would make it to the neighbor's lawn and take a nap. You know, my mom was a rageaholic. It was just crazy. It was absolutely crazy. There was so much violence in that home, you know, and everything you can imagine that happens in an abusive relationship happened in that house. But we were taught, never air your dirty story out in public. Never let anyone know anything. So I was told, never tell anybody anything, ever. And don't trust people. Don't trust anyone, because if you tell them something, eventually they're going to squeal on you, and it's going to be all over the neighborhood. So don't trust anyone. And most important of all, never show your feelings. Don't ever let anyone know how you're feeling. You just smile and say, fine, everything's fine, everything's fine. And those are the manners I had. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no manners. I had no manners whatsoever. You know, I was just wired wrong. And so when my grandfather died and all this craziness was going on around me, I just took to reading. I just hid myself in books. And I read everything I could get my hands on. I had no goals. I had no desire to be anybody. You know, a lot of alcoholics, you know, dream of being president or a scientist or a doctor. You know, that's not my story. I just wanted to get out. That's all I wanted, was to get out of there, you know. I kept reading and dreaming my dream. And the first goal I had was I was going to get out of Lowell, Massachusetts. That was number one. And the other goals were I was going to grow up and wear beautiful clothes and travel the world around and have all these handsome men chasing me. And thanks to alcohol, I achieved all those goals. I'm a visual person. I like to describe what I look like. I was in high school. I was a geek. I was a real geek. And I went to my mom. My plan to get out of Lowell was I'll go to Boston to become a nurse. No desire to be a nurse whatsoever, but I'll go to Boston to this one hospital to be a nurse, and then that's my way out. My mom thought that was a wonderful idea, so off to Boston I went. Like I said, I'm visual. I was as skinny as a pencil. I had bright red hair that stuck out to there. I had freckles everywhere, and I spit at you when I talked. Now, that's a vision for you, right? I had no social skills. I had none, you know? And I was just a geek. And I got into my little room, and there was a knock on the door, and my classmates were going out drinking that night down at the Peppermint Lounge in the Combat Zone. Would I like to go? I'll go anywhere I'm invited. So down to the Combat Zone, to the Peppermint Lounge, I went. Now, it's the 60s. There was a song out at the time, Scotch and Soda. All those heroines in my books drank scotch, so I shimmied up to the bar, and I had a Scotch and Soda. And it's holy water. It's really a shame we let normal people drink it. They do not appreciate it like we do. And instantly, my hair got straight. My freckles disappeared. I could dance in time to the music. I grew boobs where I needed them. I mean, I was at home. I loved alcohol. It did for me what so many people will tell you it did for them. It made me fit. I drank myself pretty that night. You know, and I could dance, and all these men were telling me how pretty I was and how sexy I was and how smart I was. Well, hell, I'd been reading for years. I had a lot of material to pass on. I drank at every opportunity I could. I was a blackout drinker from the very beginning, but who cares? I don't care, so long as I get to where I want to get to. I was having fun. I was out of my skin. I was out there acting like you look like you were acting, and I just loved it. I drank at every opportunity I could. I'm one of those nurses that I'd go back to the hospital. I'd be out drinking all night, and I'd get up at dark 100 and put on that white uniform that had so much starch you could walk to work by itself. And I'd take a whiff of the oxygen tent, and I'd take a couple of whiffs, and off to work I'd go. And I still have a resentment about that. You know, they're doing these oxygen treatments today, like health and beauty. I was doing it in the 60s, and I don't get any credit whatsoever. You know? It worked. And so off to work I'd go. And I was one of those people that said, tonight I'm not going to drink. Tonight I'm going to stay home. Tonight I'm going to study. Tonight I'm going to do that. But as soon as there was a knock on my door, you want to go, I was off and running. And I'm a blackout drinker, like I said. I was told I was a fighter, which I found very hard to believe, sweet little Irish girl like me. But I was told I threw the first punch. And when I came to the next morning, I just thought I was clumsy when I had black eyes and bruises. I defended my right to drink to the very end. And I finally graduated, and I got a job at the New England Deaconess Hospital, and here I am. I am ready. And it was New Year's Eve. I remember New Year's Eve, we were having a party at my house, because in those days, every New Year's Eve was sitting in the living room with your little hat and your little horn on, watching Guy Lombardo and the ball come down in Times Square. And one of my goals is I'm going to go to Times Square. And so on my way home, I thought about it. I picked up my roommate, and I just drove to the airport, and I said, get on the plane. We're going to Times Square. And I got there, and it was everything I ever imagined. It was incredible. There were people from all over the country around me, and I knew I had to go. So I went back, and the next day when I went to work, I gave 2 weeks' notice. It was eeny, meeny, miny, mo, and Miami won. Off to Miami I go. And they say that alcoholics don't have willpower. They don't know what we're like. When we want something to get done, by God, it's going to get done. Nothing is going to deter us whatsoever. And so down to Miami I go. I don't know anyone. I got a job in this little dock-in-the-box type place, the little outpatient place. Got a little place to live, and I'm walking back and forth, and I just am ready. I am ready for whatever is going to happen. And I saw these gals put up a notice for a roommate, and I looked at it, and I thought, well, maybe this is what I need to break into knowing people here. Because in this place, they were all Salvadorians and, you know, Cubans and Haitians, and not much English being spoken there, so no socializing going on there. So I looked at these roommates, I went with these roommates to look at this place, and it was a big mansion on the Miami River, exquisitely furnished. These two gals were airline stewardesses, and they traveled all the time, and they basically wanted someone that would be there most of the time. Well, I moved in. And when I moved in, I made sure that place was perfect. I did not know I was a perfectionist when I was falling off bar stools, but I made sure that place was perfect. I had a yard man, a pool man, a man for all occasions. I'm all but scrubbing the pool with a toothbrush, and I am blowing dust out of keyholes, and that place is perfect. And they came home, and they said, God, all you do is work and take care of this place. Don't you want to have some fun? Oh, God, I was so ready for fun. And there was a party that following Friday night down at the Quarterdeck Club. It was a private key club. They had those in those days. And I was so excited about going out. I went down to Burdine's and I bought a new hunting outfit, you know, one that was cut down to here and slid up to there. I was dressed on Wednesday. I had no idea where I was going, but I was ready. And they picked me up and they put me in their car and they took me down to this part of town that I shouldn't be in. And it's down the alley and up the stairs and knock three times. And what's the password? And here we go, addiction number two, right? And so the doors open, and I hear the clinking of the glasses and the soft music playing, and all of it. This place is so smoky, you can't see the hand in front of you, and it clears up, and I look into these big brown eyes, and I fall in love. I love love at first sight. I did then, I do now. If I have to think about it, I want nothing to do with it. I looked at this man, and I said to my friend, I'm going to marry him. She said, you're engaged. I said, details, that's the man I'm going to marry right there. So you kind of have a sense of my commitment level. And I believe in love at first sight. I believe in soulmates. I will say this from the very beginning. I believe in soulmates. And I know he was mine and I was his. He was a professional ocean racer. He raced in all the major races in the world. We did Transpac, we did Transatlantic, Bermuda. You know, all over the world we were racing and sailing, and it was fabulous. I just loved our life. But you know, he drank and I drank. And then we made the mistake, we got married. And we moved to Palm Beach because he got a job working for a local yacht that he wouldn't be traveling as much. And, you know, he drank and I drank and I throw the, and it's awful. We have the whole brouhaha going on. You know, if he ever got sober, he could have told you his story, but I'm here now. It says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm bodily and physically different from my fellow man. And with that guide of sponsorship, I was told that that was a chapter written just for me. Because when I start drinking, it affects my vision. You see, I can't see anything that I'm doing wrong whatsoever, but I can see what he's not doing. I can see where I'm not living, and what I'm not wearing, where I'm not going. I can see these things. And I'm my mother's daughter. I have a tongue that drips like acid, cuts like a razor blade. And I tell him what I think. And that's not conducive to a happy marriage. And worst of all, it affects my feet. I start going places I shouldn't be going, doing things I shouldn't be doing with people I shouldn't be doing them with. And we have the whole brouhaha going on. You know, we fight, I throw a punch, He throws a punch. I throw another punch. We had the police. We had the firemen. We have had it all. The ambulances. It was all going on. And the whole time, my finger is out. You know what's wrong with you? You know what's wrong with you? I'll tell you what's wrong with you. You do this again, and I am out of here. You do this again. And I'm one of those people that when I tell you I'm going to do something, I have to do it by God, whether I want to or not. And so we had one too many fights, and I went out that night, and I met his replacement. Same man with a different face, but he was a pilot, and he lived up in Oregon. So I divorced Dick. I loved him with all my heart and soul, and I divorced him because I said, I'll show you. That's my whole thing in life. I'll show you. And up to Oregon I went, and before long, the same thing is happening over and over again. I'm on the bottom again, trying to punch. And I never won a fight. I always tried, but I never won one. And one night we had a horrible fight, and this man stormed out. And the next thing I know, the police are knocking at my door that he'd been killed in a head-on collision by a drunk driver. And you think I would have felt bad, but I didn't. All I could think about then was, what about me? You see, I'm not a nice person. My whole story is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never realized how self-seeking and selfish I was until it was pointed out to me. I thought I was just in survival mode, that everybody acted like this. And I had no place to go, so I called some friends that used to come to my stay with me when I was in Miami. They were the sailors on the West Coast, and I called Lori, and she said, oh, come on down. So I came down to Newport Beach, and I was broken. I was broken. I felt like a black widow spider. Here I am divorced. I felt like I was widowed. Can't put anything together. And I am just broken. And my friends just, we moved in. And all my friends at the time were college graduates, but they're all working in the beach houses as cocktail waitresses because that's where they made the money. And I wasn't ready to do that just yet. So I got a job, another job, working, you know, in the hospital. And I'm out drinking with them all night long, getting up at dark 100, putting on that white uniform, going to work. Patients are throwing up. I'm throwing up. It was getting nasty, you know. They wanted me to take care of them, and I was too sick to take care of them, you know. I mean, it was just getting nasty. So I, too, became a cocktail waitress. And I had no idea what I was doing. I moved up to the cannery in Newport Beach and moved up there, and I had a little place on the water. And I am going to live a good life. I am going to be healthy. So I'm out there surfing every day. I learned to sail in Miami. I'm going to learn to surf in California. And I'm working in the cannery restaurant in Newport Beach, making more money than I've ever made before in my life. And all my friends are professional cocktail waitresses now, and they're saying, don't you dare put that in the bank. The government will find out about it. Don't you dare. We'll have to pay taxes. Well, I'm a team player. I didn't put it in the bank. I spent it. And I got a little place, and I went down to the Sawdust Festival, and I had paintings that went from the floor to the ceiling. You couldn't put a stamp on my walls. I had so many paintings. And then I went to the nursery, and I had trees and hanging plants. And I mean, it was like walking into the rainforest, but it was cool. It was cool. Then I got two Siamese cats, because one of anything is never enough. So I had two cats, and I am all nested in there. I am comfortable. I have arrived. And I don't want to date anyone because, like I said, I just feel like a big failure. So I went out on Halloween, and the bartender kind of took a shine to me, the married bartender at the Red Onion. And so he started sneaking around with me, and I like sneaking around with him. I love sneaking around. I didn't want a boyfriend. I didn't want to be accountable to anyone. He was there when I wanted him there and gone when I wanted him gone. He didn't say to me once, what's for dinner? Why isn't the house clean? What are you doing with your money? Not once. And I love this sneaking around. It was just perfect for me. But Clancy taught me in sobriety that you can only be bad for as long as you can be bad, then it's time to be good again. And I was feeling a little bit tacky about this because he was married to a friend of mine. And, you know, what is this, the PTA? Like nobody ever did that? Yeah. And so I'm sneaking around. And then I had that moment of clarity where I decided that this is going to stop. So I went off to Mexico with somebody else for 3 or 4 weeks, and I broke up with him. But when I came back, he had decided that he wanted to spend his life with me, and he had filed for divorce. He and his wife had split up their property, and she had already moved to Colorado, and he's mine, all mine. I didn't even like this guy, just like having an affair with him. But I don't want to look bad, so I lived with him for another 7 years so it wouldn't look bad, you know. Mary Regan used to say, every pot finds a lid to fit it, and he was mine. I mean, any time I said I want, I got. If I said I like, it was there. He was so codependent, it was absolutely wonderful. It was fabulous. I never worried about bills or anything. I was still working. My money was for me. His money was for me. That's how it was. It was fabulous, you know. And then he decided that it was time for me to take an adventure with him, and we were both surfers, so we were going to go down to the Panama Canal. So we got a little Volkswagen pop top, we had it all done out, and we headed south. And we are going to go to the Panama Canal surfing. And we are on our way, and we are drinking. I got to the town of Tequila, and I bought a big five gallon bottle of tequila, and it was on. And we were going to camp out the whole time. And we did. And most of it was fun. Most of it was nice. But you see, halfway down there, when we got to Guatemala, I found out my true love here is really a drug dealer. And he's dealing drugs in Guatemala in the 70s when there's a revolution going on. And people are getting shot left and right. You know, we'd be camping here, and the next day, the whole camp, we'd leave, and then we found out the whole camp was shot. You know, and of course I drank, wouldn't you? I mean, I had to drink to get out of this, you know? And so we kept on going. We came back. I was going to break up with him again, you know, and I think I did for a short while. And then he decided that he was going to move to Maui. And I thought that was a great idea. Because even though I'm defending my right to drink, down deep inside all of us, we know when we're not doing things right. We know when we're lying and we're cheating. We are defending everything in our power to live like this. But we all have that question, what is wrong with me? Why do I feel like this? Why can't I act? Why can't I live like everybody else? So he's going to go to Maui and I'm going to live like everybody else. And I'm determined. But you see, I hadn't taken care of myself in a long time. I had to pay the rent. I had to buy a car. I had to pay the bills. I was having a hard time with this. And I'm drinking unattended in the bars of Newport Beach. And those people like me who drink unattended in the bars of Newport Beach knows what happens. And I got into a lot of trouble. I always get into a lot of trouble, but when I get into trouble, there's one thing I know how to do, and that's leave. I can leave like that. I can go just like that. And so one of the things that happened was I was in a bad car accident. And I was really, really hurt. And he got wind of it over in Maui. And he kept calling to see how I was. And it took months for me to recuperate. And I didn't know how to pay the rent. I didn't know how to work. I didn't know how to do these things. And he said, why don't you come over to Maui and try it one more time? And I said, OK. And I vowed to him that things would be different. I vowed that things would be different. They were different, all right. They were a lot worse than anything he ever bargained for. How could I possibly keep my word to him when I can't keep it to myself? And I get over to Maui, and Kimo's restaurant was brand new. He was the opening bartender for Kimo's, and I got a job at Kimo's as a bookkeeper. Never had gotten. Then this man had his eye on me, and he offered me a job as his office manager doing all his books. You know, I hadn't even filed taxes in years. You know, so I did his books, and I'd go to work and get out of work at 5 o'clock, and Tom would be going to work at 5 o'clock, and I'd stop in just for one drink. Just for one drink. And I can never predict what's going to happen when I start drinking. Never. I'm just going to go in for one drink, and I'm going to go home. I just went in for one drink just to hear one song. Just one song. And then I'm going to go home. Just to watch the sunset. Then I'm going to go home. And most nights he made it home before I did. He got out of work at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I started doing those things that women alcoholics do when they're out there unattended, drinking in the bars of Hawaii. I was just a mess. I was just a mess, flip-flopping around, passing out left and right, getting into a lot of trouble, just a lot of trouble, defending it all the time. Thinking if I told you I didn't do it meant I didn't do it. Even though there was proof, I didn't do it, and so that's all it, believe me, you know, and it just went on like this. And finally, he threw me out. Do you know how embarrassing it is to be thrown out by a drug-dealing, alcoholic drug addict for your drinking? You know, I mean, it's embarrassing. But this other man had his eye on me, and he owned probably half of Lahaina at the time. He owned all the curio shops, the only dress shop, a lot of property, and he wanted me to go to work for him. So I went to work for him. And I am all that. I have a little house on Front Street now with a swimming pool. I drive a red Mustang convertible. I have designer clothes on. I have credit cards that I can charge whatever I want, whenever I want. I didn't realize when I took this job, he had kind of an idea that I would be his mistress, but I didn't quite get that part for a long time, you know, and it wasn't what I had signed up for. And so I would go to drink with him every single morning. I'd meet him. Our morning meeting was at the yacht club. We would stop there for coffee and we'd sit there with all the breakage. You know, here's a little bit of scotch, a little bit of tequila. We'd just fill up our coffee cups with all the breakage and a splash of coffee, and that's how we started our day. And I am drinking out of control. I never want to forget that, how bad I was drinking. And so to avoid him, I'm drinking with the wrong people. They were the right people at the time, but they were the wrong people. And I got into a lot of trouble. And when I get into trouble, what do? I leave. And so I hopped on a plane, and I had no place to go, so I went back to Mom's house in Lowell, Massachusetts. And I was on the wagon. You know that vehicle that the wheels fall off when you're not paying attention? That wagon. I am defending my right to drink. But I also know I can't predict what will happen when I pick up a drink, so I'm not drinking, because I don't want my little Irish mom to see what I'm like when I drink, just in case I overshoot the mark, you know? And I am dry as toast, and I never want to pick up Thanksgiving 1981, as long as I live. My mom was so happy. She had her three alcoholic children all around the dining room table. You know, she was just thrilled to death that we were all home. My brother Peter, somewhat of a genius, and computers were pretty new then, so he went out of the basement to work on his computer and drink. I think he's still down there drinking. And then my brother Johnny was circling the bend. He was just about wrapping up the end of his drinking, and he was nuts. He was just circling the bend. And Mama's so happy we're all there, and all I knew was sitting there is I had to have a drink. There wasn't a question about can I, will I, shall I. I had to drink. I had to. I could not handle what was going on. I was just crazed. I was ready to blow up like Vesuvius at any second. I had to drink. And so that's when I started the sneaky drinking. First was a half pint. Then was a pint. Then was a quart. Then was a half gallon. Now, my bedroom's on the second floor, and so I was trying to get these bottles up there all the time. I could get them up there okay, but I kind of forgot about bringing them down, and they were piling up like crazy, and I'm hiding them, telling my mom, oh, no need to clean my room. I'm going to clean the whole house. Don't worry about a thing, you know, and I am defending my right to drink no matter what, and I am a mess. I just know I can't go on like this. So in the meantime, I get a phone call. I've been fired from the job. Evicted from the house, the car was repossessed, and the boyfriend I had found somebody new to date and live with. And here I am thinking, what am I going to do? But all I knew is I could not stay there. I had to leave. So on January 4th, I left my mom's house in Massachusetts to go back to Hawaii. And I got to Hawaii sometime in February. I guess I drank myself cross country. In those days, there was no trail. You know, you just pick up the phone and say, hey, I think I'll come and visit you. They'd send you a ticket. You'd go. Spend a while there until you get kicked out of there. And then you'd call up somebody else. And I worked my way back to Honolulu that way. And by the time I got to Honolulu, there wasn't one person in the world who wanted anything to do with me. I had drunk away everybody. I got to Honolulu. My luggage had fallen apart. It's in two shopping bags. So all I have is two shopping bags. And I have no place to go. But I'm an alcoholic. I'll figure it out. I will figure it out. And I remembered that my friend Mary, I used to drink with her. And she was really a tacky drinker, really a lousy drinker. She had her last drink at my house, and I kicked her out. I told everyone I kicked her out because she smoked, and I was afraid she'd burn the house down. But the truth of the matter is I came home, and all my booze was gone, so I kicked her ass right out the door. I could care less where she landed. And I decided she was the only one I thought that I knew in Honolulu. So you people are old enough, you remember this. Any young people here that don't know what a telephone booth is? You know, these big boxes, they're big boxes, and you walk in, they have this big book, a lot of big books in this program. And you flip through the book, and if you find her number, and it's there, and you pick it up, you put money into this phone, and you dial the number, and if they're home, they answer. And if they don't, it rings and rings and rings, because there's no answering machines, right? So she picks up the phone, and I say, hi, I'm in Honolulu. I just got here. I think I'm on my way back to Lahaina, but I thought I'd give you a call and see how you're doing. She was so excited to hear from me. It was her one-year anniversary in AA, and they were having a party for her. Would I like to go? Absolutely. I have no place to go. I don't tell her I have no place in the world to go. Of course I'll go to your party. Sure I will. So I took the bus down to her house, and I got to the party, and all the counselors were paying all this attention to me, as they should, because this whole event would never have happened had I not thrown her out. Of course I deserve the credit. This is how I think, right? And they're all buzzing around me saying that they'd have a bed for me if I wanted to come in, but I'm going, why? I don't have a drinking problem. I have issues. I have a lot of issues. I got to get my act together. I have issues. The drinking is not the problem. But they kept saying, well, if you change your mind, we'll have a bed for you. But I don't want to be an alcoholic. And it was a President's Day weekend. Mary was going away for the weekend, so she gave me the keys to her condo. And she said, you're welcome to stay here, but come Monday, you're gone. I don't care where you go. You cannot stay here beyond Monday. You make up your mind what you want to do. Well, this is Friday, for God's sake. You know, Monday's a long way away, isn't it? You know, and I'm thinking, bad news for an alcoholic, I'm thinking. Then I remembered I had other friends over there that sailed, so I called them. And so the next day we went sailing. We sailed the entire day, and I didn't drink. See, drinking's not my problem. We sailed all day long. It was beautiful. It was just magical. And the next day was Valentine's Day, and they celebrate in the park. So I went to the park, and I danced, and we ate, and had a wonderful time all day long. Didn't drink. See, I am not an alcoholic. I am defending my right to drink. That is not my problem. I have issues. And so the next day is Sunday. There's something about a Sunday. I'm a throwaway kid. All my friends in the Catholic neighborhood, as bad as it was, they all had to go to church and communion. Then they'd go home, and they'd cook Sunday dinner, and they'd sit in the parlor, and they'd have family time, and they'd discuss their week, and they'd make their plans, and they'd talk to each other about their education and their future and whatnot. And I'm just roaming the streets, looking on windows. I had no family time. I hated Sunday. It was the loneliest day of the week. And it's Sunday, and this hole inside me from my nose to my toes opens. That loneliness, that aching emptiness, you know what I'm talking about. That aching loneliness deep inside us, it just hits me. And so there's only one solution. I go to my favorite watering hole, the yacht club. And I walk into the yacht club, and there's about 300 men in there, and I can find an alcoholic man anywhere. There was a merchant marine up in the corner, so I gave him a big old smile, and he came right on over. This was 37 years ago. It was still pretty hot. He came right on over, and I told him I was thinking about moving to Honolulu, and he thought that was a grand idea. And so, first of all, he took me to dinner, and then we went to the movies. Then he decided to show me the city lights of Tantalus up in the mountains to lure me to come to Honolulu, not knowing that he was stuck with me, you know. And on the way up, he stopped at this store, and he got a half gallon of Burgundy, and he walked to the car, threw the top off, and he handed it to me, and up to Tantalus we went. And I drank that whole half gallon all by myself. He didn't drink. He was over in the corner smoking his joints, having his own little trip, all over there in the corner, and I drank that half gallon. And it's true what they say, your whole life goes before you. How did I get here? How did this happen to me? I don't know how this happened to me. I'm not a failure. I have an education. I've tried. I've sailed with the Rockefellers, for God's sakes. I've been in Teddy Turner's home. I'm somebody. I'm not a nobody. How did I get here? How come there's no one in the world that wants anything to do with me? I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know. Nobody wants anything to do with me. They're complaining about my drinking. Nobody will let me stay with them. How did I get here? And that hole that I kept drinking. I didn't black out that night. I remember that night so clearly. I just drank and drank, choking on my own self-disgust at what was happening to my life. And so the next day, with no place else to go, I took the bus up Lily House Street, and I checked myself into St. Francis Women's Alcoholic Treatment Center. And that was February 16, 1982, and that is the day that God put me in the palm of his hands and delivered me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I cannot believe, and neither the people who knew me then believe, that I've been sober ever since, because I was not an alcoholic. I got there, they said they'd have a bed for me, and I only went in until I could figure out a deal. I knew that if I could figure out something, I'm pretty good at figuring out things, as soon as I could figure out some place to go or something to do, I knew what I needed. I needed a boyfriend or a husband, a job, some money, a home, a car. These are the things I needed. I didn't need to quit drinking, for God's sake. These are the things I needed. You people just yapping away about your drinking, you know. But you know, the only place that kept me, so I stayed there until I could figure out a deal. And when I got there, I looked around the room, and I want to tell you, I don't know how you people got so pretty over the years, but that was the sorriest bunch of women I have ever seen in my life. I looked at them thinking, I wouldn't drink with these people. And, you know, they told me, they checked me into my room, and I thought, I just want to sleep for a couple of days. I mean, it's been rough out there for me. It's been tough, you know. So I'm going to sleep for a couple of days. The next thing I know, the bell goes off, ringy, dingy, dingy. You know that bell, treatment center people? They're all going to gather in the lobby and go to an AA meeting. I'm not going. I know alcohol is not my problem. I am not going. And my friend Mary happened to be there, and she said, well, if you don't go, you don't stay. All right, just for a couple of days. I'll go to one. And she said, don't worry about it. None of your friends will be there. I said, okay, fine. So I'm a bit of a snob. I don't know if you picked that up or not yet. So In my shopping bags, I had one designer outfit left, so I put it on. It was a green felt hat with a big peacock feather, identical matching velour jacket, Calvin Klein jeans when designer jeans were brand new, and knee boots. And off I went to my first meeting. Off I go to my first meeting. And I was hot, all right. I was so hot. It was about 99 degrees hot, but I went anyway. You know, I was just... And I had a hangover that walked in the room before me. I was so sick. And I get there, and there's all these guys at the door hugging and kissing and rubbing up against, and they're so happy to see me, and I am not so happy to see them. Not at all. And all my inmates come to the front, and I stay by the back door where I belong in case I had to make my getaway. And I'm back there thinking, God, angel of death, just shoot me. How did I end up here? And the first woman gets up to speak, and her name is Mary Lake. And this woman is up there smoking, the patio kind of falling off, telling stories that no decent woman would tell in her best friend in private, kind of like I've just done. And you're all clapping and cheering, Madame Malia, you're a winner, keep coming back. And I'm back there at the door going, that woman has no breeding whatsoever. You know, what? You know. And the next guy gets up to speak, and it's Big Richard. And he is big. This is tape, so I won't tell you what I thought of him. He was big. And he's up there at the podiums talking in pidgin. He had been in a car accident. He robbed petty cash. Everyone had moved out from him. Even the dog wouldn't sleep with him. And I'm at the back door going, you bet your sweet ass. You know, I would kick you out too. And I saw all the differences and none of the similarities whatsoever. And I danced back to that treatment center because I did not have what you had, and I certainly did not want to catch it. And so the next day when the bell goes off, ringy-dingy-dingy again, I said to Mary, well, I've been. I've seen. I've gone to the mountain. I don't need to drink from that pool. No. And she said, well, you know, this is the only time you get to go in the van. And in the van, you can stop at the store and get your cigarettes and your candy and whatever you need. Oh, yay, we get to go in the van. You know, so I get in the van. I'm going to sit this one out. We stop at the little store, and I get all my supplies. And this time, we pull into Waialae-Kahala, which is the Gucci meeting. And on the way in, there's two Rolls Royces and a Mercedes. Now, it is a program of attraction, right? And I look upstairs, and there's all these handsome men. They have on Aloha shirts, long pants, smoking their cigarettes, and they're kind of a good-looking bunch. And I thought perhaps I'd been a bit hasty. A bit hasty. I will try one more meeting just to see what it's all about. So I got my peacock feather all adjusted, and up the stairs I go. And this time at the podium, blonde hair and blue eyes, the handsomest man I have ever seen in my life. I knew I'd been sentenced to AA to marry him. That's why I'm here, exactly, to marry this man. And all of a sudden, I know what's wrong with me, but this water is pouring out of my hands. My heart sounds like a bass drum. I know you can hear it in the front row. You know, I'm back to bleh. You know, that's not very sexy. I can't say a decent word. I'm detoxing is what's happening. I'm a mess. But you see, I know how to mirror people, and I listen very intently. And I'm on a mission. I told you, alcoholics, when they want something, they're going to get it. And I listened very carefully. And Steps to Freedom was his home group, so Steps to Freedom became my home group. He was at meetings 7 nights a week. I was right there with him. He went to 2 on Saturday and Sunday. I'm right there with him. I'm a firm believer. In my case, if you bring the body, the brain might follow. And I have one mission, is this guy. And, you know, I'm in these meetings every night. I have never worked so hard at anything in my life, and I'm not getting anywhere in enough, just enough, you know. In the meantime, without my knowing it, I'm sitting in these meetings, and I'm hearing people share. And whether I liked it or not, my heart heard your heart. We speak a whole language here. It's a language of the heart. And you never pointed your finger at me and said, you know what's wrong with you? You said, this is what happened to me. This is what happened to me. And I heard you share your experience. And I'd sit back there and I'd think, yeah, that happened to me. Yeah, I felt that way. Yeah, you know, I began to defrost. My head and my mouth wouldn't let me admit that, but I began to defrost. And I often wondered why I stayed here as well. And I realized many years later I stayed here because of the honesty. Honesty has legs all of its own. It stands pure. And the people were so kind. People were so kind to me. No one laughed at me. No one made fun of me. They all asked me how I was, and they waited for the answer. They offered me rides. They asked me to read. They made me feel like I was part of, in spite of myself. But I'm chasing this guy, and I'm at Steps to Freedom, and they're having elections, and I don't want to be elected. And the next thing you know, they're having elections, and this woman next to me throws my hand up. And the next thing you know, I'm the literature person. I don't want to be the damn literature person. I don't want anything to do with you people. And in those days, you had to take everything home. So they hand me this material and this sticky, gooey rack. I was embarrassed for you. It was really tacky. And I threw all the material out. I took the rack home, and I sanded it, and I painted it. And now I had my vehicle. I had my vehicle to get this man's attention. And what I did is I went down to central office and bought every bit of literature they had. I had it alphabetized and color-coded, and I waited for the literature announcement. And I gave the longest literature announcement in history, and no one ever said stop it. I would read, I would carry on. It was like the Vanna White of AA with my literature. And all these people were just laughing and telling me what a great job I was doing, you know? And, you know, 6 months into this, this guy's not paying attention. And I'm ready to give it up. Enough of this. There's other fish in the sea. And that's the night he walks by, pats me on the head, and says, keep coming back, you're a winner. And you know that's a come on, right? You know he feels the same way. And so I keep pursuing him, and finally I get a date with him. Thank you, God, I can stop going to those damn AA meetings. I am done. And he's coming to pick me up, and the phone rings, and they tell me that my mom had died that day of a heart attack. And when he picked me up, I thought he would comfort me, but he didn't. He put me in his car, and he took me to a meeting out on the North Shore, and he told those people what had happened. I had no money. I was homeless and didn't even know it. And he told those people what had happened, and they took up a collection so I could go back to Massachusetts to my mom's funeral. And you think I would have gotten the message then, but I didn't. I use people all the time. I am not a nice person when I drink. When I am in the throes of alcoholism, I am self-centered to the max. I use everybody. I am not a nice person. And the next day he took me to the airport, and I said to him, you know, my mom's quite prominent. It's going to be a big Irish wake. I'm going to have something to drink. And he slammed on the brakes. He said, you don't drink if your ass falls off. What the hell's wrong with you? And he made me angry. I love anger. It gets me moving. You know, it gets results. And I'll show you. So I went back, and I conducted myself like a lady as well as I could. And I came back thinking he'd meet me at the airport with a diamond ring, and we'd get married and live happily ever after. And he met me at the airport with a big book and a schedule of meetings. And he said that I had a disease that was killing me, and he didn't want to watch me die. Get a program, get a sponsor, get a life. I had a sponsor. I wanted to act as if. I got Yoshiko, who graduated the month before I did from the treatment center, who was Japanese, didn't speak a word of English. I could tell her whatever I wanted to and not worry about her passing it on, you know. But he told me that's not what a sponsor is all about. And so here I am now. I'm an orphan. I'm cleaning houses for a living, scrubbing toilets, thinking I was born to have a maid, not be one, angry. I had nothing going on whatsoever. And I am angry, and I only go to meetings because I have no place else to go. And there's this woman, like you, pretty woman in the front row, blonde, beautifully dressed, makeup on where it belongs, always smiling, has all these babies around her. They're so happy to be sober. They're like rabbits multiplying every week, and they're all over the place, you know, and they're just having a wonderful time. And I hated this woman, and she turned around and looked at me and asked me the question I'd been asked my entire life. What is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? You keep showing up here, and you get goofier by the day. What is your problem? And I was ready to tell her what my problem was, an old bat like you, mind your own damn business. And she's blah, 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 and I'm just waiting for her to stop so I can let her have it. She's blah, 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 just making me angrier by the minute, and blah, 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 blah. And then I hear, and you meet me at Coco's tomorrow, and she stops, and I'm ready to let her have it, and these words fly out of my mouth. Yes, ma'am. I don't know where they came from. I have no idea where they came from, but they came out of my mouth. And so I committed. You know, I'm the one that if I commit to something, it's going to get done. So I met Blanche. Blanche saved my life. She saved my life. She was not a nice woman. Everyone thought she was a wonder. She looked like a real nice, sweet woman up here. She was a bitch. She would not, you know, all my life I told you I was never to tell anyone how I felt. Trust people. I'm trusting her. I'm calling her how I feel. I don't care how you feel. Hang up. It's what you do. I mean, it's confusing sometimes to be a newcomer. It really is. You know, what do I do? Hang on. How do I hang on? Give up. You know, just let go. It's like, what? You know? And I just kept coming because I had no place else to go. And Blanche looked at me and said to me, you know, apparently our program's not doing very good. But mine is. So why don't you give me 90 days and let's see if it changes a little bit. You've been around here for a while. It's time for you to do your fifth step. Go home and write the fourth step first. No. I am not telling anybody anything. I told you that. I'm not telling you where I've been, who I've been with. I'm not doing any of that. No. And she kept saying, okay, well, if you keep drinking, she'd hang up. Like I said, it looks like she was the one, all these bunnies were having a good time. I'm miserable. And so because I had nothing else to do, I decided to take a look at it. And I'm the one who wrote my fourth step under the covers at night with a flashlight. And I started A, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote. And then I put an A next to everything that alcohol had something to do with, whether it was to me or by me. And everything on that list had an A next to it. I wrote it. There's magic when you put pen to paper. Not to the computer, not in your head, pen to paper. You put it there, no one else puts it there, you get to see exactly what it says. And I took a look at that, and I was devastated. I did not know what to do. And I called her and I said, I don't like what I wrote. I don't know if I have the nerve to tell you where I've been and what I've done. I don't know. No problem. I'll show you up Friday, whatever. So she shows up at my house. In the meantime, I'm living in Palolo. And if any of you know Hawaii, it's like where the mountains are and there's a double rainbow going on. It's all hilly. It's beautiful. And she shows up at my house on the appointed time with a big bouquet of flowers, the torch ginger, the orchids. And out of nowhere, she pulls out a little white candle. And she lights this little white candle and says, you know, Carol, let's get on our knees and say the third step prayer and ask God to come in the room and help you be honest. And we did that, and something happened. Those of you who have done this, you know what happened. God did come into that room. And I sat there with Blanche for hours, and I told her all my secrets and all my fears and all my resentments and all my judgments. I told her everything. I didn't need to look at the list. It just came out. And I never wanted to get that face looking back at me. One woman says, power, power, and one alcoholic talking to another. And she left, and she said, you know, you might have left some things undone. So meet me tonight after the meeting. And I met her, and I had coffee, and we talked a little bit more. And I want to tell you that is the day I walked freedom from bondage. I have been free ever since, absolutely free. Free of the past, free of it, you know. And I just kept going to meetings. God kept me poor for a long time, because if I had any money, I would have been out the door, you know. And then this is the time when all the Japanese were coming over buying all the property, and I was moving all the time, and, you know, I'd gotten a job at Kuakini Hospital, the dream job of my life. I absolutely loved it. You know, I was the only Caucasian that worked there, and I decided to move back to the mainland. And when I left that hospital, usually they give everyone a potluck. They had a big farewell party for me down in one of the hotels because they thought I was so special. Me, the one that wanted no one wanted anything to do with me. They had this big part, this going away party for me, and I was touched by that. And I, again, when I left, I was appointed to call Mary Regan. You call her when you get there. She used to be the director at St. Francis, so I called her. And Mary Regan was my sponsor. And what happened to me is when I moved, I had a whole new AA. I didn't have my comfort zone anymore. I had to explore to new places. And I had not been appointed to Mary, I wouldn't be standing here, because she dragged me everywhere. I wasn't going. I was afraid of you people. I just knew, you know, I had nothing. I had nothing to offer, and I knew that. All those voices in my head were loud now. I had nothing. And she would drag me. I was her driver, you know, go here, would go there, and she'd introduce me to the Clancys and the Keith Carpenters and the Clint Hodges, and I was somebody when I was with her. And then she got a new baby, and I was replaced, and I was thrown away again. I was so devastated. How could she do this to me? But I kept on coming back. Even though I didn't want to, I kept on coming back. And slowly by slowly, it became my life. It became my world. And things changed. Things changed. I don't know how they changed. You know, the truth has the claws its way to the surface when it's ready. And my truth was coming up. And I was beginning to realize who I was. You know, a lot of people have high goals. My biggest goal was mediocrity. That's all. I wanted to be in the middle. That's all I ever wanted to be. I didn't want to be down where I came from, and I didn't want to be up on the top. I had nursed with those people. I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be right in the middle. And I didn't realize that, but slowly by slowly, with Alcoholics Anonymous, you were putting me right in the middle. You always gave me a commitment. You know, Mary always had these hardcore things for me to do. And at 10 years of sobriety, I met him. I wasn't interested in dating anybody, really. I mean, I was okay by myself. And this guy was paying a lot of attention to me, and I wasn't really too crazy about him. But we slid into being an AA couple. And I loved being an AA couple. He would drive me. I'm speaking. I'm somebody. He looks good. He's got a suit and a tie and a watch and a nice car. And we're an AA couple. And I'm comfortable with this. But about 2 years into it, I'm 10 years sober, and he finds somebody else. He's been scurried away from me, taken away from me by this short, blonde midget from Newport Beach. And I was outraged. I was outraged. I was devastated. I am done. Everybody knew that he was sneaking around with her but me. And I'm done. I am so out of here. And that Kentuckian I told you about, Lynn Wilder, he said, no, you're not done. And he wrapped me up and he sent me to Clancy. You know, I was turned over to Clancy, one of the trudgettes on the 405. And Clancy never cared about what I thought or what I felt or what I knew. He was another one that would hang up on me. Told me I had to call him every day at 10 o'clock. And then I realized that other people only had to call him once a week. And I said, well, how come I have to call you every day at 10 o'clock no matter where you are? He said, because you're sicker than others. Click, you know. And, you know, and he told me, he said, you know, what you, I don't care about what you know, what you think or what you feel. It's what you do. Do what I do. Do what I do and you'll be okay. And that's the best lesson he ever gave me because I did what he did. And you know, I'm here to tell you that all my problems disappeared through neglect. I kept going forward. I did what he did. And before long, I marched myself into a never comfortable place of sobriety. And I realized that if I had a sponsor in this hand and a sponsor in that hand, I didn't have another hand left to drink. And my life changed again and it got better and better. And my life has always gotten better, no matter what I've done. All of a sudden, I'm sponsoring all these people. You know, I have a meeting at my house. I have a meeting once a month with the people I sponsor. And I'll tell you something. They're all young and beautiful. Most of them like a debutantes. And I don't know what they're rich or whatever. They're beautiful. But when I listen to them, I'm so glad I'm old and single. I am so glad, you know. But, you know, we go through life together. We go through all our life together, no matter what we do, you know. And all I do is teach them what was taught to me. And, you know, some of them don't even have a high school diploma. We get that diploma. I'm a firm believer in advancing yourself. And whatever they do, we're with them. Whether it's a birthday or a graduation, I'm there, and we're all there, hand in hand, supporting each other. We have to be there. That's mandatory. And we are. And, you know, I've watched them get their diplomas and get a job and get a life, and they start dating in AA. That's interesting. You know, and they do it the right way. And next thing you know, they're engaged. And then they get married. We're all at the weddings. Then they have a baby. And this is a rule for every single one I sponsor, if you're of childbearing age. That child will not be born unless I am in the delivery room with you. And so far, they've all agreed. And what I have seen, though, is the miracle, God's handiwork. Babies come in this world absolutely perfect. Perfect. Just like you, just like me, I came in this world perfect, you came in this world perfect. And everything I learned negatively, lying, cheating, stealing, drinking, I learned that. And with strong sponsorship in the 12 steps, I've come over here and I've unlearned that. I've unlearned that. Now I'm a decent human being. I want to go back to that that fifth step I did. When I told Blanche I was leaving Hawaii, she said, okay, but before you go, I want you to finish your steps. And we went through six and seven, and they are not the relaxing steps, let me tell you. They're the meat and potatoes. And then she told me I had to do my amends, to go home and make my list. And so I made my list, and I came back to her, and I gave her my list, and she goes, somebody's missing. I said, what are you talking about? She said, yeah, somebody's missing. Your ex-husband's not on this list. And I looked at her and said, did you hear what he did to me? Are you serious? Did you fall off a truck and hurt your head or something? Didn't you hear what he did to me? And her loving, kind way, she said, you know, if I was living with you then, I probably would have slapped you around too. Put him on the list. And, you know, because I wanted to go and have a good record with her, I made the call. He was in Miami. I was in Honolulu. And I called him to make amends for my part in it. Not meaning one single solitary word. Not one. But when you make amends, it's an amazing, something happens. You know, something happens. It always happens when you work the steps. Then all of a sudden this thing opened. It's opened up a little bit. And the next thing I knew, he loved me. And I knew I loved him. And the next thing I know, it opened. And you know, he lived in North Carolina and I lived in Hawaii. And we talked every week for 33 years. And he always wanted to get back together again, but he still drank. And I loved him enough to let him live his life. I'm not going to go over there and try and change him. I can't change anybody. I can't do it, you know. And God, the poetry came and the phone calls, and we were the best of friends. And when he died 3 years ago, we were clean, absolutely clean. I had the best relationship in 30 years because that sponsor made me do the amends. I am so grateful for that. There was another one on the list. Things, when I lived in Lahaina, for some reason, I was like, the confessional. I knew everybody's secrets. And the man I worked for was into some kind of dealings, and his wife always wanted to know. Every time I saw her, she'd start a conversation, and I'd walk away. And I didn't go back to Maui for years as a result of that, because I did not want to have to, I didn't want to lie, and I knew it would kill her if I told her the truth. So, 33 years sober, Lynn Wilder speaking. When I was 32 years sober, I was at the South Bay Roundup, and he picked me up, and he said, I want you to meet someone. And he brought me over to Larcene. Al-Anon. And I don't know what he said, but what I heard him say was, fix her. And I was outraged. What do you mean, fix me? I'm not going to Al-Anon, for Christ's sake. Get out of here, you know. But I started going because I liked Larcene. And I found out I love being a newcomer. I really love being a newcomer, to have an appointed time to call. And so every meeting I went to, I think, this is an hour of my life. I'm never getting back again. You know, these people should drink. I would never put up with that shit. You know, I don't know what's wrong with these people, you know. And slowly that gossamer curtain opened, and I realized I can't control anyone. Don't try, you know. And now a lot of my sponsees don't like the fact that I'm an Al-Anon, because they come to me with their problems, and all I say is, you know what to do. You know the right thing to do. You know what's going to happen if you don't do it. Up to you, you know. But this was one case that I didn't want to lie. So anyway, Lynn Wilder speaking and Larcene speaking at Maui Fest, and I thought, well, what do I need? Everyone should be dead by now. And so, because I was the baby over there, they all should be dead. So I say to my friend Dave Barge and Tim, we're going. Okay, so off we go. We're going on Maui Fest. And to give you a clue what I was like in Maui, I thought everyone was dead. And I got off the plane, and this woman ran up to me, Carol Mulvey, where have you been? I thought, oh God, we're on. It's on now, you know. And this one woman I didn't want to see, she called her and told her I was on the island. And the woman called me and said, let's have lunch. And I said to Dave and Tim, I can't. I don't know what I'm going to do, because I know she wants to know, and I can't tell her the truth, and I don't want to lie. I've done the steps a couple of times, and all my sponsors said, leave that alone. If God wants you, if God wants this made, it will be made. And so Tim and Dave said, I'll come with you. But I slept on it that night, and I said, that's not how you do amends. I'll take God with me and see what happens. And I walked into her house, and you think the Queen of England arrived. She was so happy to see me, she started crying. I have missed you so much, tell me all about your life. And we sat there for 2 hours, and he never came up once, not once. And I left there, and that amends had been made to her, that everything was good. And that was the last name on my amends list, the very last one. I need a plane to fly back on. I could have flown back by myself. God in his own time will tell you when to do what to do in his infinite wisdom. So what my life is like now is it's pretty darn good, you know. When after that relationship, I realized, when I threw some more step work, that I'm not relationship material. You know, I live in an alcoholic house alone, and it's pretty bad sometimes. You know, I don't. It's a good thing that nobody can hear what goes on in his head sometimes, you know. And I just realized that I better make my own way in the world, and so I did that. I changed jobs. I became a recruiter, and I went from being a nurse to a recruiter, and I started making a lot of money, and I bought my own little house and my own little car, and I have a little bit. I have the promises to me. I'll tell you what they are. I have a loving heart. I have love in my soul, a quiet mind, and a peaceful soul. I'm at ease, and a little money in the bank, thanks to the principles of AA that I've applied to work. And I do the deal. I do the deal. I am current in AA. I have seen too many fall people. You know, one of the things I tell the people I sponsor that you have to be careful of is the very gifts of AA, the very gifts that AA gives you, usually are the wheels that take you right out the door. You know, you meet him, you got to start dating, you got the husband back, you got to go to work, you got to study for school. It's too late. You know, when I was getting sober, we went to meetings from 8 to 9 and coffee every single night, and I was still at work at 5:30 the next morning. But now people can't, I mean, now it's the end of the world. I have to go home and rest up for work tomorrow at 10 o'clock. I don't understand it, but that's the way it seems to go. But we have to do what we have to do in order to get the gifts. They do not come without the work. And, you know, so I sponsor these women. I have commitments. I've always had commitments. I will always have commitments. You know, that, like I said, I started to say, the things that drive people out the door are romances and finances. And you have to be careful of that. And I've seen too many people go. I've seen too many people with long-term sobriety walk out the door. And I always ask them why. And the story is always the same. It never changes. It's always the same. They stop going to meetings. They stop talking to people. They stop sponsoring. They stop having commitments. They just rested on their laurels. And I realized this year, and it sounds funny because I am very busy in AA. I have a home group. I sponsor people. I have a sponsor. I have a panel. I have a panel the fourth Tuesday of every month in detox. That's interesting. I'm going to tell you about detox last month. I told Len about this. You know, I have a panel that I bring down a detox. And, you know, anybody that, I like young sobriety because they can relate to it better than me. And so I asked this one guy if he'd be on my panel. He said, I'd love to. God, I'd love to. I mean, I saw him at meetings. I thought he was sober for a period of time. So I came the night before, and he calls, and he says, I don't have a car. And I've asked these other two guys to come with me. I said, okay, well, I'll come pick you up. You got to pick them up, too. And so, okay. And so they're living in a recovery house. So I go down to the recovery house, and these guys are these big felons. And I have a Fiat. We squeeze them in there. We squeeze them all squeezed in there. And I find out on my panel, he's got 22 months, he's got 3 months, and he's got 30 days, and they're all squeezed in there. And they're telling me who they are. They're all felons. You know, murderers, drug dealers, sex traffickers, and I'm driving my vehicle. Oh, my God, what have I got here, right? And we get down to that panel, and I'm thinking, I don't know if I'm going to be able to go back with them or not. And they go into that panel, and I have never heard such incredible sharing ever. Ever. Those people in detox, they related. They related. These guys were so grateful. And we left that meeting, and they were dancing tall and proud, and we squeezed them all back in the Fiat. And then went to McDonald's. We all had ice cream, and I brought them home. And that's what service is. And now they're calling. They said, there's new people there every month. We want to be the regular panel. You know, I don't know if I can handle that or not, but that's what my life is like now. I live a life of dignity. I live a life of grace. And it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're new, I have to tell you about 6 years ago, I was asked to speak in Laughlin. And I said, okay. So I get to Laughlin. And 5 minutes before I'm to go downstairs to speak, I get a phone call. It's Blanche, that first sponsor. And she's living in Canada, and she heard I was speaking. She decided to come. I hadn't seen her since I left, or talked to her since I left Maui. And I had to stand at the podium and look at that face. That face that saved my life. And talk. And it was the most incredible experience of my life. What do you say to people who stick out their hand and drag you through these steps, drag you to the altar of gratitude, and take you and change your life? How do you possibly say thank you? And I asked her that, and she said, exactly what you're doing. You can't keep it, you have to give it away. You have to keep active, always, forever. May the hand of AA be there. Thank you. I'm going to steal somebody's phone. Thank you very much for having me.